Does it have a battery meter?
Ruchem Aboyim, welcome to the eighth in the series of lectures, Shi'urim, on the chapters which cover negative theology, the Rambam, in the first Chelek. The last Shi'ur, we began chapter 57, Perek Nun Zayin, that appears in the Schwartz edition on page 139. And there, the Rambam was discussing those attributes which in fact we do attribute to God in some way, namely existence and knowledge and perhaps yicholis, you know, ability. And the Rambam says that even though we attribute, let's say for example, the attribute of existence to God, the attribute we attribute to God is not the same thing as attributing existence to anything else in the world. Namely, God's essence and his existence are one and the same, which means God necessarily exists. In other words, for all objects in the world, existence is a predicate which is distinguished from an object's essence. An object can either exist or not exist. As far as the Kodesh Baruch Hu is concerned, he must necessarily exist. And so therefore, in other words, these attributes like existence and knowledge or living are not attributes in the normative sense of the word, because these attributes are at one with his essence, and therefore we cannot in fact actually claim these attributes to in fact actually lead to a contradiction to that of theology, because they don't have the same meaning as attributes as it is for other things in the world. So in other words, now, his svara, the Rambam's reasoning that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's existence is necessary, comes from a creation, a point of view. In other words, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu's existence was not necessary, so therefore his existence would have to be derived from some other object which necessarily exists, or he would have to derive his existence from something else, which means that this would contradict HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role as a creator. In other words, if some other object in the world is responsible for God's existence, so it cannot be that God is in fact the primary creator, primordial creator. So because of that, existence must necessarily be something which is necessary and not contingent. Now, I mentioned also too that in fact the Rambam in fact does not prove that God necessarily exists. The proof is derived from a creationary, from what you call a cosmological argument. In other words, cosmological argument is that Kodesh Baruch Hu's existence was not necessary, so someone else gave him existence, in which case we're going to have to define God as the creator. And of course, that's contradicted from the fact that we define the Kodesh Baruch Hu as the creator. Now, the fact is that this actually constitutes one of the cosmological proofs that Rambam presents in the beginning of the second Chayit, the second edition of the Maor Nebuchim, in chapter 1. The Rambam presents several proofs, cosmological proofs, meaning proofs of God by virtue of who created the world. In other words, the Rambam comes to the conclusion there must be a God by virtue of the fact that the world must have been created by some type of being, which identifies its properties with that of a divine entity. In fact, the third proof which he gives, as we'll get into this in a little while, there the Rambam actually speaks about the fact that a proof of God entails that he must be of necessary existence. And that actually is one of the proofs that there exists a creator, which we'll meet Hashem speak about a little bit later. I mentioned, though, however, at the end of last lecture, that the direct proof of God's existence through a means other than a creationary argument does not exist in the Rambam per se. The traditional proof of God's necessary existence by virtue of the definition of God is what's known as the ontological argument. I think actually the word ontological argument was initially, even though it was first thought up by a priest or a monk called Anselm, the term ontological argument was first, I think, coined by Kant. Kant coins it in either the Critique of Reason or other works which we'll speak about, ontological argument meaning is that God, we prove God exists by virtue of who God is. In other words, ontology is what is, in other words, what is God? And by virtue of the idea, the concept of God, then it follows logically, then God necessarily exists. In other words, that's what's called the ontological proof. This is in contradiction to the proofs that the Rambam offers the Marne Vuchim, which are not proofs of God by virtue of definition of who God is, but rather are proofs of God by virtue of the fact that by definition of necessity and causality and determinism, the world must have a creator. Now, I mentioned that the ontological proof was initially thought up, or was invented or created by Anselm, who's in the actually 11th century. And this proof actually has a very, very long history. Descartes used it. I think Leibniz used it. In fact, actually, even in recent years, there have been several philosophers that have accepted the proof. I think even Bertrand Russell accepted the proof, I read somewhere. But even as famous as it is for a proof, the ontological proof is also known for those who attacked it. I mean, there are certain people who like utterly dismissed it. One of the people who was most famous to have attacked it and is commonly considered by many people to have demolished the proof is the famous German philosopher of the 18th century, Immanuel Kant. And in several places, in particular in his one of his main works, The Critique of Pure Reason, there Kant actually, in fact, attacks and rebuts, I mean, that's overturns the ontological proof. And not only does he overturn the ontological proof, which will be of interest for us too, but actually he claims that ultimately the cosmological proof, right, is in fact based upon an ontological proof. In other words, really the cosmological proof is based upon ontological proof, and since ontological proof is flawed, so therefore, ipso facto, the cosmological proof also has to be flawed. Now, why this will be of interest to us is because, in fact, the type of cosmological proof that Kant refers to as being secretly an ontological proof is actually explicit in the Rambam. It's the Rambam's third proof of God. The Rambam's third proof of God is almost word for word the cosmological proof that Kant actually demonstrates or exhibits for the purposes of demolishing it. This is not to suggest that Kant actually took everything he knew from the Rambam. I can imagine some people quoting me on that. No, Kant did not take everything from the Rambam. But the fact is that what will be interesting of us is, in fact, the fact that Kant actually picked Rambam, actually, what Kant understood to be the cosmological proof, the Rambam lists only as a third proof of cosmological proof. The first proof of the Rambam as cosmology is certainly ostensibly not based upon any ontological proof, and it's not clear whether, in fact, actually Kant could have actually seen the flaw in that proof from an ontological point of view.
Aquinas might have lifted it whole cloth from Rambam.
Aquinas, yeah, we know Aquinas was a...
Kant's reading Aquinas.
Ah, Kant's reading Aquinas. Okay, fine, very good. So therefore, the Mais Quine, he was a Misasek, and he didn't know he was using Rambam, but he really was. That just shows us that you fed the Rambam whether you like it or not. But in any case, what I want to... The demolishing of the ontological proof is very, very interesting, and I think I really want to go into it. Once again, the ontological... I have here, as there are actually two places where Kant speaks about it. He speaks about it in the Critique of Pure Reason, but let me read for you from there, and then I'll read from these lectures on philosophical theology of Kant. I think between the two places, we should get a basic idea of what he's saying. It's important. Now, in the Ideal of Pure Reason, the English translation, which is translated by F. Max Müller, by Anger Books, my Critique of Pure Reason is all basically some pieces. That doesn't mean I schlug Kant out completely, but maybe that'll be a metaphor for future work. But in any case, where he speaks about the ontological proof is on page 398. In this edition, it's in the section called The Ideal of Pure Reason, section 4, and it's entitled, Of the Impossibility of an Ontological Proof, right? of the existence of God. So, what Kant says is the following. Kant says, summarize what he wants to say. Basically, Kant says is that, let's say the ontological proof is, I define God, let's say, as the most perfect being. So, the idea of God is that he's the most perfect being. I'm not stating whether it exists or doesn't exist. I'm just saying that the idea of God is the most perfect being. Now, I conclude from that that God must necessarily exist. Why is that true? Because if he didn't exist, that means he lacks the predicate of existence, or the property of existence, so he cannot be the most perfect being. It must be some other being that's the most perfect being. That's a contradiction in the concept of God. So it was by contradicting the very notion of God by stating that, or by admitting the possibility that it doesn't exist. So, being that that's a contradiction, it must necessarily exist. That's a version of the ontological proof. There are several versions, actually. In fact, scholars claim that Anselm actually had two versions of the ontological proof. But in any case, that's basically what the ontological proof is saying is that, in other words, defining God as the most perfect being, right, implies ipso facto that God must exist. Because non-existence would be an imperfection, and therefore it cannot be the perfect being, since other beings certainly have the property of existence. Now, Kant says, regarding this, is this, right, the following thing. If an identical judgment, I reject the predicate, retain the subject, there arises a contradiction. In other words, a person makes a statement. So, and hence I say that the form belongs to the latter necessarily. But if I reject the subject as well as the predicate, in other words, if I have a predicate and a subject, well, the subject is God. The predicate, let's say, for example, is existence. So, for example, I might, reject the predicate, say God doesn't exist, right? And I retain the subject, means, in other words, I retain God exists, but in other words, God, retain the subject, which is God, and I reject the predicate, I say doesn't exist, there's going to be a contradiction, right? But, for example, it might be that I might reject God too. In other words, but if I reject the subject as well as the predicate, there can be no contradiction. In other words, so like this, in other words, for example, to accept a triangle, and to reject the three angles is contradictory. In other words, if I say a triangle does not have three angles, that's a contradiction. Because I accepted the fact that I'm given a triangle. It doesn't have three angles. Every triangle has three angles. I guess this was before whatever it is. So because of this, it's a contradiction. But for example, I don't begin with a triangle. If I don't accept that there's a triangle. In other words, if I don't admit the existence of a triangle, so to say a triangle is more than three angles is not a contradiction. Because I reject the existence of the triangle, and therefore it won't be a contradiction. Okay? The same applies to the concept of an absolutely necessary being. The same applies to an absolutely necessary being, which is God. Remove its existence. In other words, you remove the thing itself with all its predicates, so the contradiction becomes impossible. There's nothing external to which the contradiction can apply because the thing is not meant to be externally necessary. In other words, like this. So he says, right? If you say God is almighty, that is a necessary judgment because almightiness cannot be removed. But if you accept a deity that is an infinite being with a concept of which that other concept is identical, but if you say God is not, then neither is almightiness nor any other perspective is given. They all together within such can move out of existence, and therefore there is not the slightest consciousness in that sentence. In other words, once I don't accept, I don't postulate the notion of God, then basically, anything I say about God won't be a contradiction because I haven't accepted the concept of God. So he's like this. So he says the following thing. He says, even in introducing into the concept of a thing which you wish to think in its possibility only, the concept of existence, under whatever guise it may be, you've been guilty of a contradiction. But if you're allowed to do this, you would have apparently have carried your point. But in reality, you have achieved nothing but only have committed a tautology. Right? Meaning that what? In other words, what he's saying is that, in other words, I have a concept, an idea. And I say the idea exists. But the idea is not a real thing in the world, just an idea. By positing the idea, I'm assuming its existence. To say it exists is sort of tautology. What he's really saying is, he goes on to say, being is evidently not a real predicate or a concept of something that can be added to the concept of a thing. In other words, when I say an idea exists, the word exists doesn't add anything, because once I posit the idea, then it means absolutely nothing to say it exists. I'm just positing the idea. It might exist or may not exist. It is merely the admission of a thing and of a certain determination in it. Logically, it is merely the coupla of a judgment. In other words, I've made a judgment to posit the idea of God. To say that God exists is a meaningless, a tautology, a meaningless statement. Because since it's only idea and not an object in the world, so therefore, to say that God exists doesn't mean anything. By positing the idea of God, I've already made a judgment. I've already posited his existence. I've already assumed the existence of the idea. The fact that it exists or not exists is not adding anything new to the idea. The idea has already been posited to be exist. That's what Kant's argument is. In other words, existence as a predicate is a coupla of a judgment. So, for example, so he says, the concept of a supreme being is in many respects a very useful idea. But being an idea only, it is quite incapable of increasing by itself alone our knowledge of God to what exists. In other words, I got an idea of God. But to say that necessarily exists is meaningless. Because since it's only an idea, not something in the world that can check what I can check, you know, I can check the purely whether it exists or not. So therefore, the existence of an idea exists independent of whether it exists in the world, and therefore, to say it exists doesn't add anything to the object. It's not a predicate. It's a meaningless statement. And most of the tautology. That's Kant's argument. Now, for example, in his lectures on philosophical theology, he makes the same point, too. He says, like this, he says a little bit different. Here he says a little bit differently because he speaks about God as the most perfect being. In other words, to say, right, to speak about beings, what they have, they don't have, or that beings exist that don't exist, I have to posit the concept of a being that contains all beings. And this is God. Okay? Okay, so he says, right? So he says the following thing. He says regarding, right, like this. But is the object of this concept also actual? There's another question. In other words, he says like this. But is the, right? That is another question. In order to prove the existence of such a being, they can't argue that a being containing every reality in itself must necessarily exist, since existence is also reality. If I think of an ends realism, it means a truly most perfect being, I must also think of this reality along with it. In this way, derived, thus exists such a being, and merely have a pure concept of the understanding. And this would have certainly been a splendid thing if all this proof had been correct. But then my own reason would compel me to assume the existence of such a being, and I would have to give up my own reason if I wanted to deny its existence. Further, I could then prove incontrovertibly that there can only be one such being, for I could not think of more than one being, which includes everything in itself. If there were several such beings, then either they would not be realism, or else they would have to be one and the same being. In other words, I think over here, what he's saying over here is the following thing. In other words, an idea, you can't prove that something exists, right, if it's an idea. Because by positing the idea, I assume its existence. If it's an actual object, a pink elephant, so it's not only an idea. I'm stating there's a pink elephant that exists in the world. So therefore what? So either it exists or it doesn't exist. But the idea of God, which is only an idea, it's not an object in the world. So therefore, by positing it, I'm already assuming its existence. To prove it exists is a tautology, doesn't add anything. So in fact, actually, according to Kant, right, God, which is only an idea, is in fact actually something which cannot really be objectively proven to exist. What's called a cosmological proof, according to Kant, it's really sort of like a tautology. It's an empty proof. It's meaningless. Now, so much for the ontological proof of Kant. The question is, what about the cosmological proof? So, first of all, before I even get to cosmological proof, I would like to go on in the Rambam. In Perek Nun Zayin. In other words, what Kant is saying is that the concept of God is purely a concept, and therefore you can't prove existence because by positing the concept, I'm already assuming its existence. But existence is irrelevant. It's only a concept. Now, what's interesting is, like I said before, the Rambam does not offer what's called an ontological proof. However, the Rambam does say, after he speaks about that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is one, but it's not a concept of one that's derived anywhere else. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the oneness of God is unlike the oneness of anything else. The existence of God is not like the existence of anything else. In other words, what the Rambam seems to be saying is that when he say God exists, I don't mean the same thing to say anything else exists. When I say God is one, I don't mean the same as anything, when I say anything else is one. In other words, the concept unity, oneness, is not an independent concept of oneness which I use in the world, I apply it to God. It's something that it's a God oneness. In other words, it's the oneness is part of God. It has no meaning. When I say God is one, the word, the predicate one, has no meaning. In this statement, no sense of meaning other than in relationship to God. Same thing too, when I say God exists. The word, the sentence God exists, does not mean the same thing as say anything else exists. To say God knows doesn't mean the same thing as to say anything any other person knows. The Ram uses that in Hilchos Teshuva, but also Shmona Prokem, to undo the contradiction between Bechira and Yediyah, between knowledge, God's knowledge, and free will. Says the Rambam on page 142 in the Schwartz edition, this is towards the end of Perek Nun Zayin, chapter 57. Devarim elu einim de'alamim mipnei mi shehit amen balvonis en yonam le'amisa. In other words, these things are not hidden, right, from someone who's really educated and understands the meaning of these things. In other words, the Rambam admits that these concepts are extremely difficult. And only a person, mishitamein, person who's schooled, ba'avonis hanyonim, understanding these things, truthfully, he'll understand these things. Most people don't understand these things. His boidin v'hem eifo, ayidei sha'asechel yasig oisam, reflect upon these things, says the Rambam, right? V'yavchil oisam, that the seichel, the intellect, should understand these things. For lo ayidei hachlola sha'bituyim batzbiyim aleh. Don't go by general, but how these statements are generally understood. In other words, don't use these statements as, don't treat these statements as general statements, as these statements usually use. You have to really think deeply about how what these statements mean within their own context. That's what the Rambam says. So, now, I want to claim the following thing. In other words, what the Rambam is saying is that really, in a certain sense, we can't understand these statements. These statements are not normal statements. In other words, what I'm basically saying, we say God exists is not the normal type of subject-predicate relationship when it's used vis-a-vis the existence of anything else in the world. And the Rambam says you have to really reflect upon these things, what they really mean. Now, what's interesting is that it would seem to me that the Rambam could possibly have been against an ontological proof too. In other words, an ontological proof is coming to prove that God exists like I prove anything exists. In other words, what Kant objected to in the ontological proof of Anselm and Descartes is that you can't apply the same laws of existence as a predicate in the case of God as you can apply, right, in general. I claim the Rambam is masking to Kant. Rambam says, think deeply about these things. You can't treat these statements the way you would normally treat statements of the sort whenever you speak in other aspects. So I'm not sure that the Rambam, in fact, right, would disagree with Kant. In fact, Lefiani is dying. Kant probably represents a Gilgul of this statement to the Rambam. Namely, the Rambam is saying, think very, very deeply about this, because these statements cannot be meant, cannot be treated a normal way. I think Kant's attack, if I can summarize Balabatish, Kant's attack on the use of logical argument is that you're using the word of existence in a way which is peculiar and different from the way it's normally used, and therefore you haven't proven existence in the way which existence is usually thought of. The Rambam would say the same thing. The Rambam would say the same thing. So, b'kitzur nimrod, it seems to me that the Rambam would be maskin, would agree to Kant's critique of the ontological proof. However, I want to go a little bit further. It's rather interesting that the Rambam says, think about these things, about the real truth of these things, because it sends the Rambam to very, very deep. Now, what's interesting is, the Rambam makes that statement elsewhere too. Actually, he makes that statement in several places, but I'm going to actually point to one place where he makes that statement, because you can get it on the internet. In the lectures, in the series on creation, the Rambam makes a similar statement regarding creation ex nihilo. In Chelek Beis, Perek Yud Gimel, that means section 2, chapter 13, 298 in the Schwartz edition, the Rambam says the same thing about creation ex nihilo. He says like this, Hayo bizboinin be'in hazemoit, think very deeply about this. G'day shalo techayevna oizka tanus haneged, the people should argue with you, right? Because he's speaking about the creation of time. In other words, shirezmanu mikra v'chayev shiolo noisei, etc., etc. In other words, says the Rambam, right, you should think very, very deeply about the concept that time is created. In other words, creation ex nihilo includes time too. And think deeply about this, says the Rambam. Now, why does the Rambam say, think deeply about this? So, in the shiurim, the lectures that I gave, they're available on their internet in the part of creation, I wanted to claim that what the Rambam is really saying is that creation ex nihilo is not a theory of creation. It's not a theory of creation. Because a theory of creation means to pinpoint an event of creation that took place in time. The Rambam says explicitly, creation did not take place at any time of time. God did not bring the world to Metzius at the beginning of a time. Why? Because if God brought the world to creation at the beginning of a time, then time cannot have been created. Because if I pinpoint the time of creation, I can always assert a small time before creation. Before creation is no time. Contradiction. Therefore, the statement that God created the world at time X is actually a ridiculous statement, meaning that it has no meaning if I'm speaking about creation ex nihilo. So in other words, creation ex nihilo speaks about creating the world, but it's not creation from a standpoint that can be understood objectively. It has no bearing to any type of human creation. That's really what the Rambam is saying is. And what's creation ex nihilo, describing God as a creator, has no bearing to any physical act of creation. Because the physical act of creation, right, includes the point of the time of time when the object is created. It's not a theory of creation, by definition. The theory of creation has to involve a component of time, which creation ex nihilo obviously can't be because time itself is created. So in other words, the Rambam says, think about this very carefully, meaning that don't confuse creation ex nihilo with creation. And on the basis of that, I want to conclude in those lectures of creation, that because of that, creation ex nihilo is not necessarily a contradiction to the eternity of the universe. Namely, is that the eternity of the universe and creation ex nihilo are just ways of expressing the fact that there's a human view of the world and a God view of the world. There's an irreducible dichotomy between the concept of God creating and between man's understanding of the physical world. And that's how I understood what the Rambam was really saying. Think about this deeply, that in fact, even though I'm presenting you three theories of creation, they're not three alternative theories of creation. It goes to the creation ex nihilo is really not a contradiction of theories of creation. Creation ex nihilo is just merely a concept, a musik, that God as a creator is endowed with free will, and therefore God can, in fact, produce miracles, and that God can endow man with free will. That's the concept of God. That's this irreducible dichotomy that was the main theme of the lectures on creation. Now, could it be that, in fact, actually, the Rambam is alluding to this here too? In other words, God's existence is not a statement of fact in the world. It's not a statement of fact. It's a concept, which has nothing to do with physical existence. It's an idea. Just as God's knowledge is an idea. We'll speak about what these things mean in Mitzvah Sam when we get to chapter 68. But what I want to do, the reason I'm actually going into this, because I want to refer you to, in fact, a cosmological proof of the Rambam, which I spoke about, which appears to be based upon an ontological principle. At least, it utilizes the idea of God being the rens realismo, the most perfect being. Now, what I want to do is, I want to go through the Rambam's proof of God, and then I want to read Kant's version of the cosmological proofs, and you'll see that Kant got it, came out word for word. Now, Kant's going to demolish the Rambam's cosmological proof, because he holds the ontological proof is at the basis of this. But if, in fact, a logical proof in the Rambam can't exist, because it posits the otherness of God, so Kant's argument is going to be irrelevant. In other words, Kant's argument is going to be, how could you base a cosmological proof on an ontological proof when it just talks about the proof doesn't prove existence? However, the Rambam's proof, Rambam would not prescribe to a cosmological proof, because Rambam would agree that cosmological existence, so therefore what the Rambam is proving is something different. Actually, what the Rambam is going to prove here is that when we look at the world, it necessarily was created by God. But it's not to prove the existence of God, which Kant understands the proof of God. That's what I want to claim. Now, let's see how we do this, okay? First of all, what I want to do is, I hope you don't have a Rambam in whatever it is. If you have the Swatch edition, then actually it's on 263.
From the internet.
It's on the internet?
Swatch, yeah.
Oh, very good. It's on the internet. You can get it on page 263. If you have the edition of a Pinnus, right? Then you can, you have to actually look at the second volume. I think that the first section is the first volume, because it has the introduction of Strauss and all the articles about all the Arab philosophers and the concepts. And then here's the first section. So the second section is only in the second Pinnus edition. Okay, now, I want to go to page 263. Says the Rambam like this. Now, once again, this is the third proof of the Rambam. In other words, the Rambam has offered already proofs of God. The first proof of the Rambam basically was that there cannot be an infinite number of magnitudes. There has to be something which imparts motion to the world. And that has to be, in other words, and that which imparts the world, but cannot be corporeal. That's basically the Rambam's proof in Perek Aleph. It doesn't speak about something which is necessarily existent. That's not used in Perek Aleph. That's not the first proof. The first proof basically says, the Rambam says, if movement, right, movement cannot have an infinite number of magnitudes, there has to be one thing which begins all movement. That thing which begins all movement necessarily cannot have a body, because if it's a body, then it's necessarily bound. It cannot produce movement. After a while, the world will cease to exist. The Rambam assumes that time is eternal. And so because of that, in fact, actually, the Rambam posits that there's a first mover who is not corporeal. That's the Rambam's famous proof at the beginning of Perek Aleph, the chapter 1. Now, the Rambam goes on to a third proof. The third proof is, once again, on page 263. The Rambam says, Iyun philosophy, shlishi, a philosophical idea, being in Zelakuch from Aristotle, he calls it from Aristotle, right? And I think the footnote of Professor Schwartz, in fact, is not from Aristotle, but it's from Ibn Sina, whatever it is. So the Rambam says like this: the three possibilities, right, like this. Either everything can be created and destroyed. Right? either nothing can be created or destroyed. Okay, first of all, we can't say, right, that nothing is created and destroyed, because we think we see things in the world that are created and destroyed. We can't say that nothing's created and destroyed, that things are created and destroyed, because then there wouldn't be a world. After a while, the world will cease existing. Now the Rama thing is called Lishita, said the world's eternal. Which is part of this dichotomy. In other words, when I look at the world, I have to consider it eternal. It's only when I think about God that I can speak about creation ex nihilo. So the Rambam says, what am I left with? I'm left with the fact that some things are created and destroyed, and they're not created and destroyed. Right? Or put it this way, if that's true, right? So he says that there has to be some things that are created and destroyed, but there has to be something which is not created and destroyed. In other words, there has to be at least one thing which is not created and destroyed. Okay? And this is the Chuv of Metzias. It has to be. It can be created and destroyed. Now, something which has to be, right? Why does it have to be? Either it has to be, exist by virtue of itself, or because there's a reason that has to be. Okay? So the Rambam, either way. In other words, if the thing is necessary existence of itself, has to be, so, then there's something which necessarily has to exist. Or, the reason for it necessarily existing, so that reason itself has to necessarily exist. In other words, something has to necessarily exist in and of itself, either because it itself is the cause of existence, or that which caused it to exist has to necessarily exist in and of itself. So, says the Rambam, this proves that there exists something which is of necessary existence by virtue of itself. Okay? And, right? If not for this, nothing would exist. Would have existed at any time. So, really, says the Rambam, based upon this, page 264, it's been proven, rigorously, that there's the Mechui Metzias, something that exists by virtue of itself, and there's no reason for its existence. And Rambam could have said it's not composed of things too. It doesn't have a goof, it's incorporeal, etc. Right? And this is the Creator, this is the Kodesh Baruch Hu, this is what the Rambam says. Now, so the Rambam says that basically, in other words, to account for the fact that the world exists, there has to be something which necessarily exists. And the Rambam says this which necessarily exists, that exists by virtue of itself. And then the Rambam goes on and says this thing that exists by virtue of itself, also to what? Can't be corporeal, etc., etc. And we come to the definition, all the properties of Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's the Rambam's proof. Now, I want to come to Kant has an account of the cosmological proof. I'm reading here from the Lectures of Philosophical Theology. And let's see Kant's account that claims the Rambam, same thing. Of course, it's 18th century German instead of 12th century Arabic, but let's hear what he has to say. In this proof, I suppose that something exists. I mean, got to something exists.
What was that?
In this proof, I presuppose that something exists. And thus, the proof based on this presuppos is only derived from pure reason, but it's based from experience. Like the Rambam says, something has to exist. But the experience which I begin, the simple experience I could possibly suppose. Presume experience that I am. Okay? If I'm contingent, there must be something external to me, a ground for my existence. Something must be, right? Because if everything's contingent, the world wouldn't exist. If something exists, which is the reason why I am as I am, not otherwise. For if two are contingent, now if that's contingent, then there's something else that must be for that. This absolutely necessary being, however, must contain itself the ground of its own existence. Rambam! And kind of the ground of the existence of the whole world. For the whole world is contingent, and hence it cannot contain itself the reason as for it, right? But a being which contains itself, the ground of existence of all things, also has to contain itself, the ground of its own existence. In other words, this is the same thing as the Rambam. In other words, something exists either by virtue of itself or by virtue of something else. That which is responsible for any to exist, there has to be something. Eventually, we go back and back and back. I get something which has necessarily exist. Has necessarily exist by virtue of itself. And this being is God. Okay? Okay, very, very good. Now, once the being is God, right? Right? You go on to say it's the highest perfection. It's the absolute necessary highest perfection. And then you just go to the ontological proof. Except for what pertains to its primary source, which means the existence of things in the world. This, I'm reading from Kant. This cosmological proof is probably just as abstract as the transcendental one, which means the ontological one. The source is empirical, but in order to explain the empirical, I have to come on to a being which is what? Necessarily exists by itself. And that being that exists by itself exists. In other words, so basically what Kant is saying is that the cosmological proof just on the basis of experience in the world leads me to posit the existence of a most perfect being, of a being who exists, necessarily exists. And that most perfect being, right, exists by virtue of the ontological proof. That's what Kant is saying. So in other words, so Kant says, if I've demolished the ontological argument, I've demolished what? I've demolished the cosmological argument. Because the cosmological argument, just basically takes me back to a definition of God, which evokes an ontological argument. If that's demolished, then the cosmological is demolished there too. That's what, so therefore Kant says the ontological argument is basic for cosmological argument, and therefore, because of that, I, in essence, have demolished the cosmological argument. Now, the fact is, right, that the cosmological argument, which is produced by Kant, is, I would say, almost word for word, the Rambam's cosmological argument. I mean, he quotes Wolf, who quotes about a most perfect being, but that's what the Rambam is really saying. The fact is, it's a being that's of necessary existence. However, the fact is that the Rambam, of course, right, doesn't have an ontological argument. The Rambam is really just proving the fact that there must be a creator. Whereas the Rambam is not proving that God exists. The idea of God, therefore, implies that he exists. All the Rambam is saying is that if I go back to a certain stage, I end up with a creator who's not physical, or, no, is not physical in the normal sense. I can't speak about him in the normal sense. And the fact is that the Rambam's first proof in Perek Aleph, right, you know, doesn't even speak about that same existence. He just speaks about motion. Now, I would say the following thing. I would say that the Rambam understood that the ontological concept of God doesn't prove existence. Doesn't prove existence. What I can get from experience is that in order to account for experience, I can come up with an idea of God. Who is what? Who is Bechuyav HaMetzias, who necessarily exists. But it's not from that definition of God that I prove he exists. All that I'm saying is that I can only account for the existence of the world. Right? From something which has those characteristics. So, I claim that the Rambam's cosmological proof is not in any way contingent upon ontological proof. However, what? When the Rambam is proving existence, he's not proving existence directly from the definition of God. All he's saying is that an object, a being which meets his criteria, must be responsible for the world which I see. Now, as I look at the world, I can only come back to a starting point, which is something of necessary existence. But it doesn't prove that he exists. I'm just proving that he's the necessary creator. In other words, there's an end to creation.
So,
yeah.
So in other words, the world is not a steerer to God's existence, as it would be in Kant. Rather, it's only a steerer to an account of existence, which is to be Mustaber.
Right. Right. In other words, basically, I could rationally account for a creator from the world. But, in other words, I derive the properties of the creator that he's not like the world. But I'm not using those properties to prove its existence.
So if I'm to make any sense of the world, which exists independently, if I'm to make any sense of it, I need to bring in a creator.
Right.
But it doesn't imply, the existence of the world doesn't imply the existence of the creator.
Right.
So not in the same
right.
Way.
Right. Right. He says it does, but what he does is he implies the world as a creator.
Uh-huh.
In other words, he's looking at God as a creator. In other words, the ontological proofs look at God as God. He's looking at God as the creator. Which means what the Rambam is really saying is that, in other words, I can prove there's a creator who in fact what? Who in fact, in other words, who in fact satisfies his properties. But, in other words, I can't tell you what God is. I don't understand what God is. I can say mechuyev, when I say mechuyev hametzius, is a necessary existence, that's only a relationship to the world.
So would you say
but it's not a clear concept of God that I can use in the proof of his existence.
So would you say he's proving the rationality of God?
That could possibly be. Or I think what he's doing is, he's proving that, in other words, I think like this, what he's doing is, he's proving that the world has a creator.
Mm-hmm.
Has a creator. And it makes sense to say the world is creator. But in other words, he's not proving that there's a God with those properties. What he's saying is he's proving the world has a creator who satisfies these properties. Which means like this. I can look at God as the creator, and I can God in and of himself. God in and of himself I can't prove. I assume his existence. It makes sense, but I can't prove it. The concept is so deep, I can't prove it. He agrees with that. In other words, the Rambam understands that I can speak about the world, speak about God. So long as I speak about the world, I can infer it was created by a God. But I can't speak directly about God. The ontology of the God remains too deep for me to speak about. In other words, Descartes and Anselm, whoever used the ontological proof, understood that I can have an objective definition of God. I can have a concept of God which is clear that I can prove its existence. The Rambam says this concept is beyond man's conceptual framework. Man cannot conceive the concept of God. All he can do is infer it in relationship to the physical world. But to understand the concept, you can never understand the concept. It's too deep, it's too part of me, it's too ontological. It's too of what I am, of what the world is, to really sort of about to be mocked to define it and then prove its existence. So in other words, I claim that this is really, in a certain sense, that, see, Kant understood that God is a concept which can be defined, or like, in other words, God is a concept which is defined. Well, like, kind of understood that those people who push the ontological proof, right, could treat God as a perfectly defined concept, right, and therefore prove its existence like proof of its existence. Kant says you can't use existence for that. In other words, but basically, Kant understood that these people were confused by the difference between an idea and between a physical object to the world. I claim that Rambam wasn't confused. Rambam was not confused. Rambam understood there's a difference between God as an idea and God as an accounting for the physical world. In other words, there's creation and there's the concept of God in and of itself. The concept of God in itself is too deep for me to comprehend, to prove objectively. But I can prove it in relationship to the world. In other words, I can give a rational account for the world on the basis of an object which right, which has these features. Well, basically, is not like the world. In other words, basically, this is negative theology at its best. I can prove that the world was created by something which is not from the world. But I can't tell it what it is in order to prove that it directly exists. So in other words, I think, with all due respect to Immanuel Kant, that if Kant actually read the Baruch Nevuchim and interpreted it properly, he would have understood that not everybody in history has been confused between the ontological proof and the cosmological proof. The Rambam very well understood that a cosmological proof cannot be an ontological proof because God's ontology is something which is hidden from it. All I can do is reflect upon it and understand why I can't understand it. In other words, when I reflect upon God's necessary existence, I can reflect upon what it is, but I can only reflect upon what it isn't. In other words, that it doesn't mean when the same expression is used to any other part of the world. So it's God's unknowability in and of himself which is part and parcel of what the Rambam is saying. And that's, in my opinion, the biggest side. That's why God's ontology is posited in a section of negative theology. Creation is in another section. Creation and ontology are two separate things. I can look at God as being other than the world, but I can't say what God is. Looking at God other than the world, I can prove that the world was created by something other than the world. But what that other thing is, I can't say what it is directly. I can only reflect upon why it's, I can't understand it. It's too bleak for me to understand. And I certainly can't posit it in a positive way to prove its existence. I think that's really where the Rambam would stand on these things. So the Rambam, Baruch Hashem, 500 years before Kant, I think, intuitively, I mean, he never saw an ontological proof, but I think the Rambam would have agreed with Kant that you can't prove God ontologically. To prove God ontologically is a way to Zohar, because it means I could have a concept of God, or put this way, let's not call it a way to Zohar. To prove God exists by definition of God would in fact assume a knowledge of God which is rejected by negative theology. So the Rambam's monotheism goes beyond Anselm, that's not much to say, it goes beyond Descartes too. In other words, Christianity, somehow, they were Christians, believed that I could have a notion of God, that I'm saying I can't have a notion of God. So this, it could possibly be, is really the Rambam, you know, the distinction between Christianity and Judaism, which we spoke about at the beginning of the theology. Christianity accepts some intelligibility in these ideas of God, which the Rambam would say is in direct violation of negative theology. Kant's attack the ontological principle is because Kant is a Christian attacking Christian scholars who are trying to prove God. Had he known the Rambam, he would have understood that his attack is basically for nothing, because the Rambam never attempted something like that. So in other words, Rambam and Kant agree for different reasons, but I think that really they agree. I think I read somewhere in a recent book that some of the Jews take to Kant a lot. The Neo-Kantians were all Jewish, at least everyone called was Jew. Somehow the Jews like Kant. I think even, who was it? One of the Gedalim, what's that, like a bracha on Kant? Was that Shimshur Fal Hirsch? Someone pronounced a bracha. The Jews like Kant, but not for Kant. Not for the fun reasons Kant would be. Somehow Kant's attack on Christian theology is Christians very, very Jewish. Even though I don't kind of like the Jews themselves, I probably don't like the Jews either. But that's called Umen Sonnes of Nasri. Okay, anyway. Baruch Hashem. I think we've said enough about this ontological, cosmological proof. We finished Perek Nun Zayin, which is a very, very important chapter. Perek Nun Chas, the Rambam goes even deeper. And the Rambam speaks about certain statements people make about God, which are actually, the Rambam says, are preposterous statements. They don't really refer to anything. And from there, we'll go on and go a little bit deeper into ways we can speak about God. Until then,
next week there will not be a class.
Okay, next week, my son's getting married. If you didn't see the invitation, an interview will be in Eretz Yisrael. Monday night, all the Chav Zayin, Chav Vav Cheshbon, all the Chav Zayin, Chav Vav Gmach Yud Kei Vav Kei. My son is getting married in Good Nicole here.
In an undisclosed location?
No, in a disclosed location, but it's not far from an undisclosed location in Shalayim. Whoever is listening is actually invited. This is a real invitation. Come and say hello to me, and you can even speak to me in learning on the Shi'orim. We'll be happy to speak in learning to the chasmas, things to do besides.
But there will not be a video.
There will not be a video, right. There will not be a video on Monday. We'll take a week off. And it'll give you plenty of time to come and Yerushalayim and come back into the Chasana, and we will celebrate the demolishing of Kant's demolishing of the ontological proof. And after we celebrate, we'll go back, and in 2 weeks, we'll continue in Perek Nun Ches. Until then, Zeit gesund.